He patted Guinafra's blonde hair, which was almost 6 inches long. I felt much the same about the helpless and abused little ones, too. "What kind of a world is it that doesn't have children?" Alice said. "For that matter, what kind without animals? If they can't be mistreated or abused any more, they can't be petted and loved."
"One thing balances out another in this world," Burton said. "You can't have love without hate, kindness without malice, peace without war. In any event, we don't have a choice in the matter. The invisible lords of this world have decreed that we do not have animals and that women no longer bear children. So be it." The morning of the 416th day of their journey was like every morning. The sun had risen above the top of the range on their left. The wind from upriver was an estimated 15 miles per hour, as always. The warmth rose steadily with the sun and would reach the estimated 85 degrees Fahrenheit at approximately 2 in the afternoon. The catamaran, the Hadji, tacked back and forth. Burton stood on the bridge with both hands on the long, thick pine tiller on his right, while the wind and the sun beat on his darkly tanned skin. He wore a scarlet and black checked kilt reaching almost to his knees and a necklace made of the convoluted, shiny black vertebrae of the hornfish. This was a 6-foot-long fish with a 6-inch-long horn that projected unicorn-like from its forehead. The hornfish lived about 100 feet below the surface and was brought in on a line with difficulty. But its vertebrae made beautiful necklaces. Its skin, properly tanned, made sandals and armor and shields, or could be worked into tough, pliable ropes and belts. Its flesh was delicious. But the horn was the most valuable item. It tipped spears or arrows or went into a wood handle to make a stiletto. On a stand near him, encased in the transparent bladder of a fish, was a bow. It was made of the curved bones protruding from the sides of the mouth of the whale-sized dragonfish. When the ends of each had been cut so that one fitted into the other, a double recurved bow was the result. Fitted with a string from the gut of the dragonfish, this made a bow that only a very powerful man could fully draw. Burton had run across one 40 days ago and offered its owner 40 cigarettes, 10 cigars, and 30 ounces of whiskey for it. The offer was turned down. So Burton and Kaz came back late that night and stole the bow, or rather made a trade since Burton felt compelled to leave his U-bow in exchange. Since then, he had rationalized that he had every right to steal the bow. The owner had boasted that he had murdered a man to get the bow, so taking it from him was taking it from a thief and a killer. Nevertheless, Burton suffered from thrusts of conscience when he thought about it, which was not often. Burton took the Hadji back and forth across the narrowing channel. For about 5 miles, the river had widened out to a 3.5-mile broad lake, and now it was forming into a narrow channel less than 0.5 mile across. The channel curved and disappeared between the walls of a canyon. There the boat would creep along because it would be bucking an accelerated current, and the space allowed for tacking was so limited. But he had been through similar straits many times, and so was not apprehensive about this. Still, every time it happened, he couldn't help thinking of the boat as being reborn. It passed from a lake, a womb, through a tight opening and out into another lake. It was a bursting of waters in many ways, and there was also the chance of a fabulous adventure, of a revelation on the other side. The catamaran turned away from a grailstone, only 20 yards off. There were many people on the right side plane, which was only 0.5 mile across here. They shouted at the boat, or waved, or shook their fists, or shouted obscenities, unheard, but understood by Burton because of so many experiences. But they didn't seem hostile. It was just that strangers were always greeted by the locals in a varied manner. The locals here were a short, dark-skinned, dark-haired, thin-bodied people. They spoke a language that Ruach said was probably Proto-Hamite-Semitic. They had lived on Earth somewhere in North Africa or Mesopotamia when those countries had been much more fertile. They wore the towels as kilts, but the women went bare-breasted and used the bras as neck scarves or turbans. They occupied the right bank for 60 grailstones, that is, 60 miles. The people before them had been strung out for 80 grailstones and had been 10th century A.D. Ceylonese with a minority of pre-Columbian Mayans. The mixing bowl of time,
Frigate called the distribution of humanity, the greatest anthropological and social experiment ever. His statements were not too far-fetched. It did look as if the various peoples had been mixed up so that they might learn something from each other. In some cases, the alien groups had managed to create various social lubricants and live in relative amity. In other cases, there was a slaughter of one side by the other, or a mutual near-extermination, or slavery of the defeated. For some time after the resurrection, anarchy had been the usual rule. People had milled around and formed little groups for defense in very small areas. Then the natural leaders and power-seekers had come to the front, and the natural followers had lined up behind the leaders of their choice, or the leader's choice in many cases. One of the several political systems that had resulted was that of Grail slavery. A dominant group in an area held the weaker prisoners. They gave the slave enough to eat because the Grail of a dead slave became useless. But they took the cigarettes, the cigars, the marijuana, the dream gum, the liquor, and the tastier food. At least 30 times, the Haji had started to put into a Grail stone and had come close to being seized by Grail slavers. But Burton and the others were on the alert for signs of slave states. Neighboring states often warned them. 20 times, boats had put out to intercept them instead of trying to lure them ashore, and the Haji had narrowly escaped being run down or boarded. 5 times, Burton had been forced to turn back and sail downstream. His catamaran had always outrun the pursuers, who were reluctant to chase him outside their borders. Then the Haji had sneaked back at night and sailed past the slavers. A number of times the Haji had been unable to put into shore because the slave states occupied both banks for very long stretches. Then the crew went on half rations, or if they were lucky, caught enough fish to fill their bellies. The proto-Hamite-Semites of this area had been friendly enough after they were assured that the crew of the Haji had no evil intentions. An 18th-century Muscovite had warned them that there were slave states on the other side of the channel. He didn't know too much about them because of the precipitous mountains. A few boats had sailed through the channel, and almost none had returned. Those that did brought news of evil men on the other side. So the Haji was loaded with bamboo shoots, dried fish, and supplies saved over a period of 2 weeks from the Grails. There was still about half an hour before the strait would be entered. Burton kept half his mind on his sailing and half on the crew. They were sprawled on the foredeck, taking in the sun, or else sitting with their backs against the roofed combing, which they called the forecastle. John de Greystock was affixing the thin, carved bones of a hornfish to the butt of an arrow. The bones served quite well as feathers in a world where birds didn't exist. Greystock, or Lord Greystoke, as Frigate insisted on calling him for some private self-amusing reason, was a good man in a fight or when hard work was needed. He was an interesting, if almost unbelievably vulgar, talker, full of anecdotes of the campaigns in Gascony and on the border, of his conquests of women, of gossip about Edward Longshanks, and, of course, of information about his times. But he was also very hard-headed and narrow-minded in many things, from the viewpoint of a later age, and not overly clean. He claimed to have been very devout in earth life, and he probably told the truth. Otherwise he wouldn't have been honored by being attached to the retinue of the Patriarch of Jerusalem. But now that his faith had been discredited, he hated priests, and he was apt to drive any he met into a fury with his scorn, hoping that they would attack him. Some did, and he came close to killing them. Burton had cautiously reprimanded him for this. You didn't speak harshly to de Greystock unless you wished to fight to the death with him, pointing out that when they were guests in a strange land and immensely outnumbered by their hosts, they should act as guests. De Greystock admitted that Burton was right, but he couldn't keep from baiting every priest he met. Fortunately, they weren't often in areas where there were Christian priests. Moreover, there were very few of these who admitted that they had been such. Beside him, talking earnestly, was his current woman, born Mary Rutherford in 1637, died Lady Warwickshire in 1674. She was English, but of an age 300 years later than his, so there were many differences in their attitudes and actions. Burton didn't give them much longer to stay together.
Kaz was sprawled out on the deck with his head in the lap of Fatima, a Turkish woman whom the Neanderthal had met 40 days ago during a lunch stop. Fatima, as Frigate had said, seemed to be hung up on hair. That was his explanation for the obsession of the 17th-century wife of a baker of Ankara for Kaz. She found everything about him stimulating, but it was the hairiness that sent her into ecstasies. Everybody was pleased about this, most of all Kaz. He hadn't seen a single female of his own species during their long trip, though he had heard about some. Most women shied away from him because of his hairy and brutish appearance. He had had no permanent female companionship until he met Fatima. Little Lev Ruach was leaning against the forward bulkhead of the forecastle, where he was making a slingshot from the leather of a hornfish. A bag by his side contained about 30 stones, picked up during the last 20 days. By his side, talking swiftly, incessantly exposing her long white teeth, was Esther Rodriguez. She had replaced Tanya, who had been henpecking Lev before the Haji set off. Tanya was a very attractive and petite woman, but she seemed unable to keep from remodeling her men. Lev found out that she had remodeled her father and uncle and 2 brothers and 2 husbands. She tried to do the same for, or to, Lev, usually in a loud voice, so that other males in the neighborhood could benefit by her advice. One day, just as the Haji was about to sail, Lev had jumped aboard, turned and said, "Goodbye, Tanya. I can't stand any more reforming from the big mouth from the Bronx. Find somebody else, somebody that's perfect." Tanya had gasped, turned white, and then started screaming at Lev. She still was screaming, judging by her mouth, long after the Haji had sailed out of earshot. The others laughed and congratulated Lev, but he only smiled sadly. 2 weeks later, in an area predominantly ancient Libyan, he met Esther, a 15th-century Sephardic Jewess. "Why don't you try your luck with a Gentile?" Frigate had said. Lev had shrugged his narrow shoulders. "I have. But sooner or later you get into a big fight and they lose their temper and call you a goddamn kike. The same thing also happens with my Jewish women, but from them I can take it." "Listen, friend," the American said, "there are billions of Gentiles along this river who've never heard of a Jew. They can't be prejudiced. Try one of them." "I'll stick to the evil I know."
"You mean you're stuck to it," Frigate said.
Burton sometimes wondered why Ruach stayed with the boat. He had never made any more references to the Jew, the Gypsy, and El Islam, though he often questioned Burton about other aspects of his past. He was friendly enough, but had a certain indefinable reserve. Though small, he was a good man in a fight, and he had been invaluable in teaching Burton judo, karate, and jukado. His sadness, which hung about him like a thin mist, even when he was laughing or making love, according to Tanya, came from mental scars. These resulted from his terrible experiences in concentration camps in Germany and Russia, or so he claimed. Tanya had said that Lev was born sad. He inherited all the genes of sorrow from the time when his ancestors sat down by the willows of Babylon. Monat was another case of sadness, though he could come out of it fully at times. The Tau Seton kept looking for one of his own kind, for one of the 30 males and females who had been torn apart by the lynch mob. He didn't give himself much chance. 30, in an estimated 35 to 36 billion strung out along a river that could be 10 million miles long, made it improbable that he would ever see even one. But there was hope. Alice Hargreaves was sitting forward of the forecastle, only the top of her head in his view, and looking at the people on the banks whenever the boat got close enough for her to make out individual faces. She was searching for her husband, Reginald, and also for her 3 sons, and for her mother and father and her sisters and brothers, for any dear, familiar face. The implications were that she would leave the boat as soon as this happened. Burton hadn't commented on this, but he felt a pain in his chest when he thought of it. He wished that she would leave, and yet he did not wish it. To get her out of sight would eventually be to get her out of his mind. It was inevitable. But he didn't want the inevitable. He felt for her as he had for his Persian love, and to lose her too would be to suffer the same long live torture. Yet he had never said a word about how he felt to her. He talked to her, jested with her, showed her a concern that he found galling because she didn't return it,
and in the end got her to relax when with him. That is, she would relax if there were others around. When they were alone, she tightened up. She had never used the dream gum since that first night. He had used it for a third time, and then hoarded his share and traded it for other items. The last time he had chewed it, with the hope of an unusually ecstatic lovemaking with Wilfrida, he had been plunged back into the horrible sickness of the little irons, the sickness that had almost killed him during his expedition to Lake Tanganyika. Speke had been in the nightmare, and he had killed Speke. Speke had died in a hunting accident, which everybody had thought was a suicide, even if they hadn't said so. Speke, tormented by remorse because he had betrayed Burton, had shot himself. But in the nightmare, he had strangled Speke when Speke bent over to ask him how he was. Then, just as the vision faded, he had kissed Speak's dead lips. Chapter 14. Well, he had known that he had loved Speke at the same time that he hated him, justifiably hated him. But the knowledge of his love had been very fleeting and infrequent, and it hadn't affected him. During the dream gum nightmare, he had felt so horrified at the realization that love lay far beneath his hate that he had screamed. He awakened to find Wilfrida shaking him, demanding to know what had happened. Wilfrida had smoked opium or drunk it in her beer when on Earth, but here, after one session with dream gum, she had been afraid to chew any more. Her horror came from seeing again the death of a younger sister from tuberculosis and at the same time reliving her first experience as a whore. "It's a strange psychedelic," Ruach had told Burton. He had explained what the word meant. The discussion about that had gone on for a long time. "It seems to bring up traumatic incidents in a mixture of reality and symbolism. Not always. Sometimes it's an aphrodisiac. Sometimes, as they said, it takes you on a beautiful trip. But I would guess that dream gum has been provided us for therapeutic, if not cathartic, reasons. It's up to us to find out just how to use it." "Why don't you chew it more often?" Frigate had said. "For the same reason that some people refuse to go into psychotherapy, or quit before they were through, I'm afraid." "Yeah, me too," Frigate said. "But someday when we stop off someplace for a long time, I'm going to chew a stick every night, so help me, even if it scares hell out of me. Of course, that's easy to say now." Peter Jairus Frigate had been born only 28 years after Burton had died, yet the world between them was wide. They saw so many things so differently. They would have argued violently, if Frigate was able to argue violently, not on matters of discipline in the group or in running the boat, but on so many matters of looking at the world. Yet, in many ways, Frigate was much like Burton, and it may have been this that had caused him to be so fascinated by Burton on Earth. Frigate had picked up in 1938 a softcover book by Fairfax Downey titled Burton, Arabian Nights Adventurer. The front page illustration was of Burton at the age of 50, the savage face, the high brow and prominent supraorbital ridges, the heavy black brows, the straight but harsh nose, the great scar on his cheek, the thick, sensual lips, the heavy, down-drooping mustache, the heavy forked beard, the essential broodingness and aggressiveness of the face had caused him to buy the book. "I'd never heard of you before, Dick," Frigate said, "but I read the book at once and was fascinated. There was something about you, aside from the obvious derring-do of your life, your swordsmanship, mastery of many languages, disguises as a native doctor, native merchantman, as a pilgrim to Mecca, the first European to get out of the sacred city of Hara alive, discoverer of Lake Tanganyika and near-discoverer of the source of the Nile, co-founder of the Royal Anthropological Society, inventor of the term ESP, translator of the Arabian Nights, student of the sexual practices of the East, and so forth. Aside from all this, fascinating enough in itself, you had a special affinity for me. I went to the public library. Peoria was a small city, but had many books on you and about you, donated by some admirer of yours who'd passed on, and I read these. Then I started to collect first editions by you and about you. I became a fiction writer eventually, but I planned to write a huge, definitive biography of you, travel everywhere you had been, take photographs and notes of these places,
found a society to collect funds for the preservation of your tomb. This was the first time Frigid had mentioned his tomb. Burton, startled, said, "Where?" Then, "Oh, of course, Mortlake. I'd forgotten."
Was the tomb really in the form of an Arab tent, as Isabel and I had planned?
Sure, but the cemetery was swallowed up in a slum. The tomb was defaced by vandals. There were weeds up to your tuchus and talk of moving the bodies to a more remote section of England, though by then it was hard to find a really remote section.
"And did you found your society and preserve my tomb?" Burton said.
He had gotten used to the idea by then of having been dead, but to talk with someone who'd seen his tomb made his skin chill for a moment. Frigate took a deep breath. Apologetically, he said, "Now, by the time I was in a position to do that, I would have felt guilty spending time and money on the dead. The world was in too much of a mess. The living needed all the attention they could get. Pollution, poverty, oppression, and so forth. These were the important things. And that giant, definitive biography." Again, Frigate spoke apologetically. "When I first read about you, I thought I was the only one deeply interested in you or even aware of you. But there was an upsurge of interest in you in the 60s. Quite a few books were written about you, and even one about your wife."
"Isabel? Someone wrote a book about her? Why?"
Frigate had grinned. "She was a pretty interesting woman. Very aggravating, I'll admit. Pitifully superstitious and schizophrenic and self-fooling. Very few would ever forgive her for burning your manuscripts and your journals."
"What?"
Burton had roared.
"Burn?"
Frigate nodded and said, "What your doctor, Grenfell Baker, described as the ruthless holocaust that followed his lamented death. She burned your translation of The Perfumed Garden, claiming you wouldn't have wanted to publish it unless you needed the money for it, and you didn't need it, of course, because you were now dead." Burton was speechless for one of the few times in his life. Frigate looked out of the corner of his eye at Burton and grinned. He seemed to be enjoying Burton's distress. Burning The Perfumed Garden wasn't so bad, though bad enough. But to burn both sets of your journals, the private ones in which supposedly you let loose all your deepest thoughts and most burning hates, and even the public ones, the Diary of Daily Events, well, I never forgave her. Neither did a lot of people. That was a great loss. Only one of your notebooks, a small one, escaped, and that was burned during the bombing of London in World War II. He paused and said, "Is it true that you converted to the Catholic Church on your deathbed, as your wife claimed?"
"I may have," Burton said. "Isabel had been after me for years to convert, though she never dared urge me directly. When I was so sick there at the last, I may have told her I would do so in order to make her happy. She was so grief-stricken, so distressed, so afraid my soul would burn in hell."
"Then you did love her," Frigate had said.
"I would have done the same for a dog," Burton replied.
For somebody who can be so upsettingly frank and direct, you can be very ambiguous at times. This conversation had taken place about 2 months after first day AR-1. The result had been something like that which Dr. Johnson would have felt on encountering another Boswell. This had been the second stage of their curious relationship. Frigate became closer, but at the same time more of an annoyance. The American had always been restrained in his comments on Burton's attitudes, undoubtedly because he didn't want to anger him. Frigate made a very conscious effort not to anger anybody, but he also made unconscious efforts to antagonize them. His hostilities came out in many subtle and some not-so-subtle actions and words. Burton didn't like this. He was direct, not at all afraid, of anger. Perhaps, as Frigate pointed out, he was too eager for hostile confrontations. One evening, as they were sitting around a fire under a grailstone, Frigate had spoken about Karachi. This village, which later became the capital of Pakistan, the nation created in 1947, had only 2,000 population in Burton's time. By 1970, its population was approximately 2 million. That led to Frigate's asking, rather indirectly, about the report Burton had made to his general, Sir Robert Napier, on houses of male prostitution in Karachi. The report was supposed to be kept in the secret files of the East India Army, but it was found by one of the many enemies of Burton. Though the report was never mentioned publicly, it had been used against him throughout his life. Burton had disguised himself as a native in order to get into the house and make observations that no European would have been allowed to make. He had been proud that he had escaped detection, and he had taken the unsavory job because he was the only one who could do it, and because his beloved leader, Napier, had asked him to. Burton had replied to Frigate's questions somewhat surlily. Alice had angered him earlier that day, she seemed to be able to do so very easily lately, and he was thinking of a way to anger her. Now he seized upon the opportunity given him by Frigate. He launched into an uninhibited account of what went on in the Karachi houses. Ruach finally got up and walked away. Frigate looked as if he were sick, but he stayed. Wilfrida laughed until she rolled on the ground. Kaz and Monat kept stolid expressions. Gwenafra was sleeping on the boat, so Burton didn't have to take her into account. Logu seemed to be fascinated, but also slightly repulsed. Alice, his main target, turned pale and then later red. Finally she rose and said, "Really, Mr. Burton, I had thought you were low before, but to brag of this, you are utterly contemptible, degenerate, and repulsive. Not that I believe a word of what you've been telling me. I can't believe that anybody would behave as you claim you did and then boast about it. You're living up to your reputation as a man who likes to shock others, no matter what damage it does to his own reputation." She had walked off into the darkness. Frigate had said, "Sometime maybe you'll tell me how much of that is true. I used to think as she did, but when I got older, more evidence about you was turned up, and one biographer made a psychoanalysis of you based on your own writing and various documentary sources." "And the conclusions?" Burton said mockingly. "Later, Dick," Frigate said. "Ruffian Dick," he added, and he too left. Now, standing at the tiller, watching the sun beat down on the group, listening to the hissing of water cut by the two sharp prows and the creaking of rigging, he wondered what lay ahead on the other side of the canyon-like channel. Not the end of the river, surely. That would probably go on forever. But the end of the group might be near. They had been cooped up too long together. Too many days had been spent on the narrow deck with too little to do except talk or help sail the ship. They were rubbing each other raw and had been doing it for a long time. Even Wilfrida had been quiet and unresponsive lately. Not that he had been too stimulating. Frankly, he was tired of her. He didn't hate her or wish her any ill, he was just tired of her, and the fact that he could have her and not have Alice Hargreaves made him even more tired of her. Lev Ruach was staying away from him, or speaking as little as possible, and Lev was arguing even more with Esther about his dietary habits and his daydreaming, and why didn't he ever talk to her? Frigate was mad at him about something, but Frigate would never come out and say anything, the coward, until he was driven into a corner and tormented into a mindless rage. Logu was angry and scornful of Frigate because he was sullen with her as with the others. Logu was also angry with him, Burton, because he had turned her down when they had been alone gathering bamboo in the hills several weeks ago. He had told her no, adding that he had no moral scruples against making love to her, but that he would not betray Frigate or any other member of the crew. Logu said that it wasn't that she did not love Frigate, it was just that she needed a change now and then, just as Frigate did. Alice had said that she was about to give up hope of ever seeing anybody she knew again. They must have passed an estimated 44,370,000 people at least, and not once had she seen anybody she had known on Earth. She had seen some that she had mistaken for old acquaintances, and she admitted that she had only seen a small percentage of the 44,370,000 at close range or even at far range. But that didn't matter. She was getting abysmally depressed and weary of sitting on this cramped foredeck all day, with her only exercise handling the tiller or the rigging or opening and closing her lips with conversation, most of it inane. Burton didn't want to admit it, but he was afraid that she might leave. She might just get off at the next stop, walk off onto the shore with her grail and few belongings and say goodbye, see you in 100 years or so, perhaps. The chief thing keeping her on the boat so far had been Gwenafra. She was raising the little ancient Briton as a Victorian lady come post-resurrection mores child. This was a most curious mixture, but not any more curious than anything else along the river. Burton himself was weary of the eternal voyaging on the little vessel. He wanted to find some hospitable area and settle down there to rest, then to study, to engage in local activities, to get his land legs back, and allow the drive to get out and away to build up again. But he wanted to do it with Alice as his hutmate. "The fortune of the man who sits also sits," he muttered. He would have to take action with Alice. He had been a gentleman long enough. He would woo her, he would take her by storm. He had been an aggressive lover when a young man, then he had gotten used to being the loved, not the lover, after he got married. And his old habit patterns, old neural circuits, were still with him. He was an old person in a new body. The Haji entered the dark and turbulent channel. The blue-black rock walls rose on both sides, and the boat went down a curve, and the broad lake behind was lost. Everybody was busy then, jumping to handle the sails as Burton took the Haji back and forth in the quarter-mile-wide stream and against a current that raised high waves. The boat rose and dipped sharply and heeled far over when they changed course abruptly. It often came within a few feet of the canyon walls, where the waves slapped massively against the rock. But he had been sailing the boat so long that he had become a part of it, and his crew had worked with him so long that they could anticipate his orders, though they never acted ahead of them. The passage took about 30 minutes. It caused anxiety in some, no doubt of Frigate and Ruach being worried, but it also exhilarated all of them. The boredom and the sullenness were, temporarily, at least, gone. The Haji came out into the sunshine of another lake. This was about 4 miles wide and stretched northward as far as they could see. The mountains abruptly fell away. The plains on both sides resumed the usual mile width. There were 50 or so craft in view, ranging from pine dugouts to 2-masted bamboo boats. Most of them seemed to be engaged in fishing. To the left, a mile away, was the ubiquitous Grailstone, and along the shore were dark figures. Behind them, on the plain and hills, were bamboo huts in the usual style of what Frigate called Neo-Polynesian, or sometimes post-mortem riparian architecture. On the right, about 1/2 mile from the exit of the canyon, was a large log fort. Before it were 10 massive log docks with a variety of large and small boats. A few minutes after the Haji appeared, drums began beating. These could be hollow logs, or drums made with tanned fish skin or human skin. There was already a crowd in front of the fort, but a large number swarmed out of it, and from a collection of huts behind it. They piled into the boats, and these cast off. On the left bank, the dark figures were launching dugouts, canoes, and single-masted boats. It looked as if both shores were sending boats out in a competition to seize the Haji first. Burton took the boat back and forth as required, cutting in between the other boats several times. The men on the right were closer. They were white and well-armed, but they made no effort to use their bows. A man standing in the prow of a war canoe with 30 paddlers shouted at them in German to surrender. "You will not be harmed." "We come in peace," Frigate bawled at him. "He knows that," Burton said. "It's evident that we few aren't going to attack them." Drums were beating on both sides of the river now. It sounded as if the lake shores were alive with drums, and the shores were certainly alive with men, all armed. Other boats were being put out to intercept them. Behind them, the boats that had first gone out were pursuing, but losing distance. Burton hesitated. Should he bring the Haji on around and go back through the channel and then return at night? It would be a dangerous maneuver because the 20,000-foot-high walls would block out the light from the blazing stars and gas sheets. They would be almost blind. And this craft did seem to be faster than anything the enemy had. So far, that is. Far in the distance, tall sails were coming swiftly toward him. Still, they had the wind and current behind them, and if he avoided them, could they outstrip him when they too had to tack? All the vessels he had seen so far had been loaded with men, thus slowing them down. Even a boat that had the same potentialities as the Haji would not keep up with her if she were loaded with warriors. He decided to keep on running upriver. 10 minutes later, as he was running close-hauled, another large war canoe cut across his path. This held 16 paddlers on each side and supported a small deck in the bow and the stern. 2 men stood on each deck beside a catapult mounted on a wooden pedestal. The 2 in the bow placed a round object which sputtered smoke in the pocket of the catapult. One pulled a catch, and the arm of the machine banged against the crossbeam. The canoe shuddered, and there was a slight halt in the deep rhythmic grunting of the paddlers. The smoking object flew in a high arc until it was about 20 feet in front of the Hadji and 10 feet above the water. It exploded with a loud noise, and much black smoke quickly cleared away by the breeze. Some of the women screamed, and a man shouted. He thought there was sulfur in this area, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to make gunpowder. He called to Logu and Esther Rodriguez to take over at the tiller. Both women were pale, but they seemed calm enough, although neither woman had ever experienced a bomb. Guanafra had been put inside the forecastle. Alice had a U-bow in her hand and a quiver of arrows strapped to her back. Her pale skin contrasted shockingly with the red lipstick and the green eyelid makeup, but she had been through at least 10 running battles on the water, and her nerves were as steady as the chalk cliffs of Dover. Moreover, she was the best archer of the lot. Burton was a superb marksman with a firearm, but he lacked practice with the bow. Kaz could draw the river dragon horn bow even deeper than Burton, but his marksmanship was abominable. Frigate claimed it would never be very good. Like most pre-literates, he lacked a development of the sense of perspective. The catapult men didn't fit another bomb to the machine. Evidently, the bomb had been a warning to stop. Burton intended to stop for nothing. Their pursuers could have shot them full of arrows several times, but they had refrained meant that they wanted the Hadji crew alive. The canoe, water boiling from its prow, paddles flashing in the sun, paddlers grunting in unison, passed closely to the stern of the Hadji. The two men on the foredeck leaped outward and the canoe rocked. One man splashed into the water, his fingertips striking the edge of the deck. The other landed on his knees on the edge. He gripped a bamboo knife between his teeth. His belt held two sheaths, one with a small stone axe and the other with a hornfish stiletto. For a second, as he tried to grab onto the wet planking and pull himself up, he stared upward into Burton's eyes. His hair was a rich yellow, his eyes were a pale blue, and his face was classically handsome. His intention was probably to wound one or two of the crew and then to dive off, maybe with a woman in his arms. While he kept the Hadji crew busy, his fellows would sail up and engage the Hadji and pour aboard, and that would be that. He didn't have much chance of carrying out his plan. Probably knew it, and didn't care. Most men still feared death because the fear was in the cells of their bodies and they reacted instinctively. A few had overcome their fear, and others had never really felt it. Burton stepped up and banged the man on the side of the head with his axe. The man's mouth opened, the bamboo knife fell out, he collapsed face down on the deck. Burton picked up the knife, untied the man's belt, and shoved him off into the water with his foot. At that, a roar came from the men in the war canoe which was turning around. Burton saw that the shore was coming up fast, and he gave order to tack. The vessel swung around, and the boom swung by. Then they were beating across the river with a dozen boats speeding toward them. Three were four-man dugouts, four were big war canoes, and five were two-masted schooners. The latter held a number of catapults and many men on the decks. Halfway across the river, Burton ordered the Hadji swung around again. The maneuver allowed the sail ships to get much closer, but he had calculated for that. Now, sailing close-hauled again, the Hadji cut water between the two schooners. They were so close that he could clearly see the features of all aboard both craft. They were mostly Caucasian, though they ranged from very dark to Nordic pale. The captain of the boat, on the port side, shouted in German at Burton, demanding that he surrender. "We will not harm you if you give up, but we will torture you if you continue to fight." He spoke German with an accent that sounded Hungarian. For reply, Burton and Alice shot arrows. Alice's shaft missed the captain but hit the helmsman, and he staggered back and fell over the railing. The craft immediately veered. The captain sprang to the wheel, and Burton's second shaft went through the back of his knee. Both schooners struck slantingly with a great crash and shot off with much tearing up of timbers, men screaming and falling onto the decks or falling overboard. Even if the boats didn't sink, they would be out of action. But just before they hit, their archers had put a dozen flaming arrows into the bamboo sails of the Hadji. The shafts carried dry grass, which had been soaked with turpentine made from pine resin, and these, fanned by the wind, spread the flames quickly. Burton took the tiller back from the women and shouted orders. The crew dipped fired clay vessels and their open grails into the river, and then threw the water on the flames.
Logu, who could climb like a monkey, went up the mast with a rope around her shoulder. She let the rope down and pulled up the containers of water. This permitted the other schooners and several canoes to draw close, one on a course which would put it directly in the path of the Haji. Burton swung the boat around again, but it was sluggish because of Logu's weight on the mast. It wheeled around, the boom swung wildly as the men failed to keep control of its ropes, and more arrows struck the sail and spread more fire. Several arrows thunked into the deck. For a moment, Burton thought that the enemy had changed his mind and was trying to down them, but the arrows were just misdirected. Again the Haji sliced between two schooners. The captains and the crew of both were grinning. Perhaps they had been bored for a long time and were enjoying the pursuit. Even so, the crews ducked behind the railings, leaving the officers, helmsmen, and the archers to receive the fire from the Haji. There was a strumming, and dark streaks with red heads and blue tails went halfway through the sails in 24 places. A number drove into the mast or the boom. A dozen hissed into the water, one shot by Burton a few inches from his head. Alice, Ruach, Kaz, de Greystock, Wilfrida, and he had shot while Esther handled the tiller. Logu was frozen halfway up the mast, waiting until the arrow fire quit. The five arrows found three targets of flesh, a captain, a helmsman, and a sailor, who stuck his head up at the wrong time for him. Esther screamed, and Burton spun. The war canoe had come out from behind the schooner and was a few feet in front of the Haji's bow. There was no way to avoid a collision. The two men on the platform were diving off the side, and the paddlers were standing up or trying to stand up so they could get overboard. Then the Haji smashed into its port near the bow, cracking it open, turning it over, and spilling its crew into the river. Those on the Haji were thrown forward, and de Greystock went into the water. Burton slid on his face and chest and knees, burning off the skin. Esther had been torn from the tiller and rolled across the deck until she thumped against the edge of the forecastle, combing. She lay there, without moving. Burton looked upward. The sail was blazing away beyond hope of being saved. Logu was gone, so she must have been hurled off at the moment of impact. Then getting up, he saw her and de Greystock swimming back to the Haji. The water around them was boiling with the splashing of the dispossessed canoemen, many of whom, judging by their cries, couldn't swim. Burton called to the men to help the two aboard while he inspected the damage. Both prows of the very thin twin hulls had been smashed open by the crash. Water was pouring inside, and the smoke from the burning sail and mast was curling around them, causing Alice and Gwenaphra to cough. Another war canoe was approaching swiftly from the north. The two schooners were sailing close-hauled toward them. They could fight and draw some blood from their enemies who would be holding themselves back to keep from killing them, or they could swim for it. Either way, they would be captured. Logu and de Greystock were pulled aboard. Frigate reported that Esther couldn't be brought back to consciousness. Ruach felt her pulse and opened her eyes, and then walked back to Burton. She's not dead, but she's totally out. Burton said, "You women know what will happen to you. It's up to you, of course, but I suggest you swim down as deeply as you can and draw in a good breath of water. You'll wake up tomorrow, good as new." Gwenaphra had come out of the forecastle. She wrapped her arms around his waist and looked up, dry-eyed but scared. He hugged her with one arm and then said, "Alice, take her with you." "Where?" Alice said. She looked at the canoe and back at him. She coughed again as more smoke wrapped around her, and then she moved forward, upwind. "When you go down," he gestured at the river. "I can't do that," she said. "You wouldn't want those men to get her, too. She's only a little girl, but they'll not stop for that." Alice looked as if her face was going to crumple and wash away with tears, but she didn't weep. She said, "Very well. It's no sin now, killing yourself. I just hope..." He said, "Yes?" He didn't drawl the word. There was no time to drawl anything out. The canoe was within 40 feet of them. "The next place might be just as bad or worse than this one," Alice said. "And Gwenaphra will wake up all alone. You know that the chances of us being resurrected at the same place are slight." "That can't be helped," he said. She clamped her lips, then opened them and said, "I'll fight until the last moment. Then..." "It may be too late," he said. He picked up his bow and drew an arrow from his quiver. De Greystock had lost his bow, so he took Kaz's. The Neanderthal placed a stone in a sling and began whirling it.
Lev picked up his sling and chose a stone for its pocket. Monat used Esther's bow since he had lost his also. The captain of the canoe shouted in German, "Lay down your arms! You won't be harmed!" He fell off the platform onto a paddler a second later as Alice's arrow went through his chest. Another arrow, probably to Greystock, spun the second man off the platform and into the water. A stone hit a paddler in the shoulder and he collapsed with a cry. Another stone struck glancingly off another paddler's head and he lost his paddle. The canoe kept on coming. The two men on the aft platform urged the crew to continue driving toward the Haji. Then they fell with arrows in them. Burton looked behind them. The two schooners were letting their sails drop now. Evidently they would slide on up to the Haji where the sailors would throw their grappling hooks into it. But if they got too close, the flames might spread to them. The canoe rammed into the Haji with 14 of the original complement dead or too wounded to fight. Just before the canoe's prow hit, the survivors dropped their paddles and raised small round leather shields. Even so, two arrows went through two shields and into the arms of the men holding them. That still left 20 men against 6 men, 5 women, and a child. But one was a 5-foot-high hairy man with tremendous strength and a big stone axe. Kaz jumped into the air just before the canoe rammed the starboard hull and came down in it a second after it had halted. His axe crushed 2 skulls and then drove through the bottom of the canoe. Water poured in, and de Greystock shouted something in his Cumberland Middle English, leaped down beside Kaz. He held a stiletto in one hand and a big oak club with flint spikes in the other. The others on the Haji continued to shoot their arrows. Suddenly, Kaz and de Greystock were scrambling back onto the catamaran, and the canoe was sinking with its dead, dying, and its scared survivors. A number drowned, the others either swam away or tried to get aboard the Haji. These fell back with their fingers chopped off or stamped flat. Something struck on the deck near him, and then something else coiled around him. Burton spun and slashed at the leather rope which had settled around his neck. He leaped to one side to avoid another and yanked savagely at a third rope and pulled the man on the other end over the railing. The man, screaming, pitched out and struck the deck of the Haji with his shoulder. Burton smashed in his face with his axe. By now, men were dropping from the decks of both schooners and ropes were falling everywhere. The smoke and the flames added to the confusion, though they may have helped the Haji's crew more than the boarders. Burton shouted at Alice to get Gwynafra and jump into the river. He couldn't find her, and then had to parry the thrust of a big black man with a spear. The man seemed to have forgotten any orders to capture Burton. He looked as if he meant to kill. Burton knocked the short spear aside and whirled, lashing out as he went by with the axe and smashed its edge against the black's neck. Burton continued to whirl, felt a sharp pain in his ribs, another in his shoulder, but knocked 2 men down and then was in the water. He fell between the schooner and the Haji, went down, released the axe, and pulled the stiletto from its sheath. When he came up, he was looking up at a tall, raw-boned, red-headed man who was lifting the screaming Gwynafra above him with both hands. The man pitched her far out into the water. Burton dived again, and coming up saw Gwynafra's face only a few feet before him. It was gray, and her eyes were dull. Then he saw the blood darkening the water around her. She disappeared before he could get to her. He dived down after her, caught her, and pulled her back up. A hornfish tip was stuck into her back. He let her body go. He didn't know why the man had killed her, when he could have easily taken her prisoner. Perhaps Alice had stabbed her, and the man had figured that she was as good as dead, and so had tossed her over the side to the fishes. A body shot out of the smoke, followed by another. One man was dead with a broken neck, the other was alive. Burton wrapped his arm around the man's neck and stabbed him at the juncture of jaw and ear. The man quit struggling and slipped down into the depths. Frigate leaped out from the smoke, his face and shoulders bloody. He hit the water at a slant and dived deep. Burton swam toward him to help him. There was no use even trying to get back on the craft. It was solid with struggling bodies, and other canoes and dugouts were closing in. Frigate's head rose out of the water. His skin was white where the blood was not pumping out over it. Burton swam to him and said, "Did the women get away?" Frigate shook his head and then said, "Watch out!" Burton upended to dive down. Something hit his legs. He kept on going down, but he couldn't carry out his intention of breathing in the water. He would fight until they had to kill him. On coming up, he saw that the water was alive with men who had jumped in after him and Frigate. The American, half-conscious, was being towed to a canoe. Three men closed in on Burton, and he stabbed two, and then a man in a dugout reached down with a club and banged him on the head.
Chapter 15. They were led ashore near a large building behind a wall of pine logs. Burton's head throbbed with pain at every step. The gashes in his shoulder and ribs hurt, but they had quit bleeding. The fortress was built of pine logs, had an overhanging second story, and many sentinels. The captives were marched through an entrance that could be closed with a huge log gate. They marched across 60 feet of grass-covered yard and through another large gateway into a hall about 50 feet long and 30 wide. Except for Frigate, who was too weak, they stood before a large round table of oak. They blinked in the dark and cool interior before they could clearly see the two men at the table. Guards with spears, clubs, and stone axes were everywhere. A wooden staircase at one end of the hall led up to a runway with high railings. Women looked over the railings at them. One of the men at the table was short and muscular. He had a hairy body, black curly hair, a nose like a falcon's, and brown eyes as fierce as a falcon's. The second man was taller, had blonde hair, eyes the exact color of which was difficult to tell in the dusky light but were probably blue, and a broad Teutonic face. A paunch and the beginning of jowls told of the food and liquor he had taken from the grails of slaves. Frigate had sat down on the grass, but he was pulled up to his feet when the blonde gave a signal. Frigate looked at the blonde and said, "You look like Hermann Göring when he was young." Then he dropped to his knees, screaming with pain from the impact of a spear butt over his kidneys. The blonde spoke in an English with a heavy German accent. "No more of that unless I order it. Let them talk." He scrutinized them for several minutes, then said, "Yes, I am Hermann Göring."
"Who is Göring?" Burton said.
"Your friend can tell you later," the German said, "if there is a later for you. I am not angry about the splendid fight you put up. I admire men who can fight well. I can always use more spears, especially since you killed so many. I offer you a choice. You men, that is. Join me and live well with all the food, liquor, tobacco, and women you can possibly want, or work for me as my slaves."
"For us," the other man said in English. "You forget, Hermann, that I have used as much to say about this as you."
Göring smiled, chuckled, and said, "Of course, I was only using the royal I, you might say. Very well, we. If you swear to serve us, and it will be far better for you if you do, you will swear loyalty to me, Hermann Göring, and to the one-time king of ancient Rome, Tullius Hostilius."
Burton looked closely at the man. Could he actually be the legendary king of ancient Rome? Of Rome when it was a small village threatened by the other Italic tribes? The Sabines, Equi, and Volsci, who in turn were being pressed by the Umbrians, themselves pushed by the powerful Etruscans. Was this really Tullius Hostilius, warlike successor to the peaceful Numa Pompilius? There was nothing to distinguish him from 1,000 men whom Burton had seen on the streets of Siena. Yet, if he was what he claimed to be, he could be a treasure trove, historically and linguistically speaking. He would, since he was probably Etruscan himself, know that language, in addition to pre-classical Latin and Sabine and perhaps Campanian Greek. He might even have been acquainted with Romulus, supposed founder of Roma. What stories that man could tell.
"Well," Göring said. "What do we have to do if we join you?" Burton said. "First, we have to make sure that you are the caliber of man we want. In other words, a man who will unhesitatingly and immediately do anything that we order. We will give you a little test."
He gave an order, and a minute later a group of men was brought forward. All were gaunt, and all were crippled.
They were injured while quarrying stone or building our walls,
Goering said,
except for two caught while trying to escape. They will have to pay the penalty. All will be killed because they are now useless, so you shouldn't hesitate about killing them to show your determination to serve us. He added, besides, they are all Jews. Why worry about them?
Campbell, the redhead, who had thrown Guanafra into the river, held out to Burton a large club studded with chert blades. Two guards seized a slave and forced him to his knees. He was a large blonde with blue eyes and a Grecian profile. He glared at Goering and then spat at him. Goering laughed.
He has all the arrogance of his race. I could reduce him to a quivering, screaming mass, begging for death if I wanted to. But I do not really care for torture. My compatriot would like to give him a taste of the fire, but I am essentially a humanitarian.
I will kill in defense of my life, or in defense of those who need protection, Burton said. But I am not a murderer.
Killing this Jew would be an act in defense of your life, Goering replied. If you do not, you will die anyway. Only it will take you a long time.
I will not, Burton said. Goering sighed.
You English. Well, I would rather have you on my side, but if you don't want to do the rational thing, so be it.
What about you? He said to Frigate. Frigate, who was still in agony, said, your ashes ended in a trash heap in Dachau because of what you did and what you were. Are you going to repeat the same criminal acts on this world?
Goering laughed and said, I know what happened to me. Enough of my Jewish slaves have told me.
He pointed at Monat.
What kind of a freak is that?
Burton explained. Goering looked grave, then said,
I couldn't trust him. He goes into the slave camp. You there, ape man, what do you say?
Kaz, to Burton's surprise, stepped forward.
I kill for you. I don't want to be slave.
He took the club, while the guards held their spears, poised to run him through if he had other ideas for using it. He glared at them from under his shelving brows, then raised the club. There was a crack, and the slave pitched forward on the dirt. Kaz returned the club to Campbell and stepped aside. He did not look at Burton.
Goering said, all the slaves will be assembled tonight, and they will be shown what will happen to them if they try to get away. The escapees will be roasted for a while, then put out of their misery. My distinguished colleague will personally handle the club. He likes that sort of thing.
He pointed at Alice.
That one. I'll take her.
Tullius stood up.
No, no, I like her. You take the others, Hermann. I give you both of them. But, Sai, I want her very muck. Sai look like, what you say, aristocrat, a queen.
Burton roared, snatched a club from Campbell's hand, and leaped upon the table. Goering fell backward, the tip of the club narrowly missing his nose. At the same time, the Roman thrust a spear at Burton and wounded him in the shoulder. Burton kept hold of the club, whirled, and knocked the weapon out of Tullius's hand. The slaves, shouting, threw themselves upon the guards. Frigate jerked a spear loose and brought the butt of it against Kaz's head. Kaz crumpled. Monak kicked a guard in the groin and picked up his spear. Burton didn't remember anything after that. He awoke several hours before dusk. His head hurt worse than before. His ribs and both shoulders were stiff with pain. He was lying on grass in a pine log enclosure with a diameter of about 50 yards. 15 feet above the grass, circling the interior of the wall, was a wooden walk on which armed guards paced. He groaned when he sat up. Frigate, squatting near him, said, I was afraid you'd never come out of it. Where are the women? Burton said. Frigate began to weep. Burton shook his head and said,
quit blubbering. Where are they?
Where the hell do you think they are? Frigate said.
Oh, my God. Don't think about the women. There's nothing you can do for them. Not now, anyway.
Why wasn't I killed after I attacked Goering? Frigate wiped away the tears and said,
beats me. Maybe they're saving you and me for the fire.
As an example. I wish they had killed us.
"What so recently gained paradise and wish so soon to lose it?" Burton said. He began to laugh, but quit because pain speared his head. Burton talked to Robert Spruce, an Englishman born in 1945 in Kensington. Spruce said that it was less than a month since Goering and Tullius had seized power. For the time being, they were leaving their neighbors in peace. Eventually, of course, they would try to conquer the adjacent territories, including the Onondaga Indians across the river. So far, no slave had escaped to spread word about Goering's intentions. "But the people on the borders can see for themselves that the walls are being built by slaves," Burton said. Spruce grinned wryly and said, "Goering has spread the word that these are all Jews, that he's only interested in enslaving Jews, so what do they care? As you can see for yourself, that is not true. Half of the slaves are Gentile." At dusk, Burton, Frigate, Ruach, de Greystoke, and Monat were taken from the stockade and marched down to a Grail Rock. There were about 200 slaves there, guarded by about 70 Goeringites. Their grails were placed on the rock, and they waited. After the blue flames roared, the grails were taken down. Each slave opened his, and guards removed the tobacco, liquor, and half of the food. Frigate had gashes in his head and in his shoulder which needed sewing up, though the bleeding had stopped. His color had much improved, though his back and kidneys pained him. "So now we're slaves," Frigate said. "Dick, you thought quite a lot of the institution of slavery. What do you think of it now?" "That was Oriental slavery," Burton said. "In this type of slavery, there's no chance for a slave to gain his freedom, nor is there any personal feeling except hatred between slave and owner. In the Orient, the situation was different. Of course, like any human institution, it had its abuses." "You're a stubborn man," Frigate said. "Have you noticed that at least half the slaves are Jews? Late 20th century Israeli, most of them. That girl over there told me that Goering managed to start Grail slavery by stirring up anti-Semitism in this area. Of course, it had to exist before it could be aroused. Then, after he had gotten into power with Tullius' aid, he enslaved many of his former supporters." He continued, "The hell of it is, Goering is not, relatively speaking, a genuine anti-Semite. He personally intervened with Himmler and others to save Jews, but he is something even worse than a genuine Jew-hater. He is an opportunist. Anti-Semitism was a tidal wave in Germany. To get any place, you had to ride the wave. So, Goering rode there just as he rode here. An anti-Semite, such as Goebbels or Frank, believed in the principles they professed. Perverted and hateful principles, true, but still principles. Whereas big, fat, happy-go-lucky Goering didn't really care one way or the other about the Jews. He just wanted to use them." "All very well," Burton said, "but what has that got to do with me?" "Oh, I see, that look. You're getting ready to lecture me." "Dick, I admire you as I have admired few men. I love you as one man loves another. I am as happy and delighted to have had the singular good luck to fall in with you as, say, Plutarch would be if he had met Alcibiades or Theseus. But I'm not blind. I know your faults, which are many, and I regret them." "Just which one is it this time?" "That book, The Jew, the Gypsy, and El Islam. How could you have written it? A hate document full of bloody-minded nonsense, folk tales, superstitions, ritual murders indeed. I was still angry because of the injustices I had suffered at Damascus. To be expelled from the consulate because of the lies of my enemies, among whom..." "That doesn't excuse your writing lies about a whole group," Frigate said. "Lies? I wrote the truth." "You may have thought they were truths, but I come from an age which definitely knows that they were not. In fact, no one in his right mind in your time would have believed that crap." "The facts are," Burton said, "that the Jewish moneylenders in Damascus were charging the poor 1,000% interest on their loans. The facts are that they were inflicting this monstrous usury not only on the Muslim and Christian populace, but on their own people. The facts are that when my enemies in England accused me of anti-Semitism, many Jews in Damascus came to my defense. It is a fact that I protested to the Turks when they sold the synagogue of the Damascus Jews to the Greek Orthodox bishop so he could turn it into a church. It is a fact that I went out and drummed up 18 Muslims to testify in behalf of the Jews. It is a fact that I protected the Christian missionaries from the Druzes.
It is a fact that I warned the Druzes that that fat and oily Turkish swine, Rashid Pasha, was trying to incite them to revolt so he could massacre them. It is a fact that when I was recalled from my consular post because of the lies of the Christian missionaries and priests, of Rashid Pasha and of the Jewish usurers, thousands of Christians, Muslims, and Jews rallied to my aid, though it was too late then. It is also a fact that I don't have to answer to you or to any man for my actions.
How like Frigate to bring up such an irrelevant subject at such an inappropriate time. Perhaps he was trying to keep from blaming himself by turning his fear and anger on Burton. Or perhaps he really felt that his hero had failed him. Lev Ruach had been sitting with his head between his hands. He raised his head and said hollowly, "Welcome to the concentration camp, Burton. This is your first taste of it. It's an old tale to me, one I was tired of hearing from the beginning. I was in a Nazi camp and I escaped. I was in a Russian camp and I escaped. In Israel I was captured by Arabs and I escaped. So now perhaps I can escape again. But to what? To another camp? There seems to be no end to them. Man is forever building them and putting the perennial prisoner, the Jew, or what have you, in them. Even here, where we have a fresh start, where all religions, all prejudices should have been shattered on the anvil of resurrection, little is changed." "Shut your mouth," a man near Ruach said. He had red hair, so curly it was almost kinky, blue eyes and a face that might have been handsome if it hadn't been for his broken nose. He was 6 feet tall and had a wrestler's body. "Dov Targov here," he said in a crisp Oxford accent, "late commander in the Israeli Navy. Pay no attention to this man. He's one of the old-time Jews, a pessimist, a whiner. He'd rather wail against the wall than stand up and fight like a man." Ruach choked and then said, "You arrogant Sabra, I fought, I killed, and I am not a whiner. What are you doing now, you brave warrior? Aren't you a slave as much as the rest of us?" "It's the old story," a woman said. She was tall and dark-haired and probably would have been a beauty if she hadn't been so gaunt. "The old story. We fight among ourselves while our enemies conquer. Just as we fought when Titus besieged Jerusalem and we killed more of our own people than we did the Romans. Just as..." The two men turned against her, and all three argued loudly until the guard began beating them with a stick. Later, through swollen lips, Targov said, "I can't take much more of this, much longer. Soon, well, that god is mine to kill." "You have a plan?" Frigate said, eagerly. But Targov wouldn't answer. Shortly before dawn, the slaves were awakened and marched to the Grey Rock. Again they were given a modicum of food. After eating, they were split up into groups and marched off to their differing assignments. Burton and Frigate were taken to the northern border. They were put to work with 1,000 other slaves, and they toiled naked all day in the sun. Their only rest was when they took their grails to the rock at noon and were fed. Goering meant to build a wall between the mountain and the river. He also intended to erect a second wall, which would run for the full 10-mile length of the lakeshore, and a third wall at the southern end. Burton and the others had to dig a deep trench and then pile the dirt taken from the hole into a wall. This was hard work, for they only had stone hoes with which to hack at the ground. Since the roots of the grass formed a thickly tangled complex of very tough material, they could be cut only with repeated blows. The dirt and roots were scraped up on wooden shovels and tossed onto large bamboo sleds. These were dragged by teams onto the top of the wall where the dirt was shoveled off to make the wall even higher and thicker. At night, the slaves were herded back into the stockade. Here, most of them fell asleep almost at once, but Targov, the red-headed Israeli, squatted by Burton. "The grapevine gives a little juice now and then," he said. "I heard about the fight you and your crew made. I also heard about your refusal to join Goering and his swine." "What do you hear about my infamous book?" Burton said. Targov smiled and said, "I never heard of it until Ruach brought it to my attention. Your actions speak for themselves. Besides, Ruach is very sensitive about such things.
Not that you can really blame him after what he went through, but I do not think that you would behave as you did if you were what he said you are. I think you're a good man, the type we need, so...
Days and nights of hard work and short rations followed. Burton learned through the grapevine about the women. Wilfrida and Fatima were in Campbell's apartment. Logu was with Tullius. Alice had been kept by Goering for a week, then had been turned over to a lieutenant, a Manfred von Kreischaft. Rumor was that Goering had complained of her coldness and had wanted to give her to his bodyguards to do with as they pleased, but von Kreischaft had asked for her. Burton was in agony. He couldn't endure the mental images of her with Goering and von Kreischaft. He had to stop these beasts, or at least die trying. Late that night, he crawled from the big hut he occupied with 25 men into Targov's hut and woke him up.
"You said you knew that I must be on your side," he whispered. "When are you going to take me into your confidence? I might as well warn you now that if you don't do so at once, I intend to foment a break among my own group and anybody else who will join us."
"Ruach has told me more about you," Targov said. "I didn't understand, really, what he was talking about. Could a Jew trust anyone who wrote such a book? Or could such a man be trusted not to turn on them after the common enemy has been defeated?"
Fenton opened his mouth to speak angrily, then closed it. For a moment he was silent. When he spoke, he did so calmly. "In the first place, my actions on earth speak louder than any of my printed words. I was the friend and protector of many Jews. I had many Jewish friends." "That last statement is always a preface to an attack on the Jews," Targov said. "Perhaps. However, even if what Ruach claims were true, the Richard Burton you see before you in this valley is not the Burton who lived on earth. I think every man has been changed somewhat by his experience here. If he hasn't, he is incapable of change. He would be better off dead."
"During the 476 days that I have lived on this river, I have learned much. I am not incapable of changing my mind. I listened to Ruach and Frigate. I argued frequently and passionately with them, and though I did not want to admit it at the time, I thought much about what they said."
"Jew hate is something bred into the child," Tarkov said. "It becomes part of the nerve. No act of will can get rid of it unless it is not very deeply embedded, or the will is extraordinarily strong. The bell rings, and Pavlov's dog salivates. Mention the word Jew, and the nervous system storms the citadel of the mind of the Gentile, just as the word Arab storms mine. But I have a realistic basis for hating all Arabs."
"I have pled enough," Burton said. "You will either accept me or reject me. In either case, you know what I will do."
"I accept," Targov said. "If you can change your mind, I can change mine. I've worked with you, eaten bread with you. I like to think I'm a good judge of character. Tell me, if you were planning this, what would you do?"
Targov listened carefully. At the end of Burton's explanation, Targov nodded.
"Much like my plan. Now..."
Chapter 16. The next day, shortly after breakfast, several guards came for Burton and Frigate. Targov looked hard at Burton, who knew what Targov was thinking. Nothing could be done except to march off to Goering's palace. He was seated in a big wooden chair and smoking a pipe. He asked them to sit down and offered them cigars and wine.
"Every once in a while," he said, "I like to relax and talk with somebody besides my colleagues who are not overly bright. I like especially to talk with somebody who lived after I died, and to men who were famous in their time. I have few of either type so far."
"Many of your Israeli prisoners lived after you," Frigate said.
"Ah, the Jews," Goering airily waved his pipe. "That is the trouble. They know me too well. They are sullen when I try to talk to them, and too many have tried to kill me for me to feel comfortable around them. Not that I have anything against them. I don't particularly like Jews, but I had many Jewish friends."
Burton reddened.
Goering, after sucking on his pipe, continued.
"Der Führer was a great man, but he had some idiocies. One of them was his attitude towards Jews. Myself,
I cared less. But the Germany of my time was anti-Jewish, and a man must go with a zeitgeist if he wants to get any place in life. Enough of that. Even here a man cannot get away from them.
He chatted on for a while and asked Triggett many questions concerning the fate of his contemporaries and the history of post-war Germany.
If you Americans had had any political sense, you would have declared war on Russia as soon as we surrendered. We would have fought with you against the Bolshevik, and we would have crushed them.
Triggett didn't reply. Göring then told several funny, very obscene stories. He asked Burton to tell him about the strange experience he had had before being resurrected in the valley. Burton was surprised. Had Göring learned about this from Kaz, or was there an informer among the slaves? He told in full detail everything that had happened between the time he opened his eyes to find himself in the place of floating bodies to the instant when the man in the aerial canoe pointed the metal tube at him. The extraterrestrial monad has a theory that some beings, call them whomever or X, have been observing mankind since he ceased to be an ape, for at least 2 million years. These super beings have, in some manner, recorded every cell of every human being that ever lived from the moment of conception, probably to the moment of death. This seems a staggering concept, but it is no more staggering than the resurrection of all humanity and the reshaping of this planet into one river valley. The recordings may have been made when the recordees were living, or it may be that these super beings detected vibrations from the past, just as we on Earth saw the light of stars, as they had been 1,000 years before. Monat, however, inclines to the former theory. He doesn't believe in time travel, even in a limited sense. Monat believes that the X's stored these recordings. How, he doesn't know. But this planet was then reshaped for us. It is obviously one great river world. During our journey upriver, we've talked to dozens whose descriptions leave no doubt that they come from widely scattered parts, from all over. One was from far up in the northern hemisphere, another far down in the southern. All the descriptions fall together to make a picture of a world that has been reworked into one zigzagging river valley. The people we talked to were killed or died by accident here, and were resurrected again in the areas we happened to be traveling through. Monat says that we resurrectees are still being recorded, and when one of us dies again, the up-to-the-minute recordings are being placed somewhere, maybe under the surface of this planet, and played into energy-matter converters. The bodies were reproduced as they were at the moment of death, and then the rejuvenating devices restored the sleeping bodies,
probably in that same chamber in which I awoke.
After this, the bodies, young and whole again, were recorded and then destroyed, and the recordings were played out again, this time through devices under the ground. Once more, energy-matter converters, probably using the heat of this planet's molten core as energy, reproduced us above the ground near the Grailstones.
I don't know why they are not resurrected a second time in the same spot where they died, but then I don't know why all our hairs were shaven off, or why men's facial hairs don't grow, or why men were circumcised and women made virgins again, or why we were resurrected. For what purpose? Whoever put us here has not shown up to tell us why.
The thing is, Triggett said, the thing is we are not the same people we were on Earth. I died, Burton died, you died, Hermann Göring, everybody died, and we cannot be brought back to life.
Göring sucked on his pipe noisily, stared at Triggett, and then said,
"Why not? I am living again? Do you deny that?"
"Yes, I do deny that, in a sense. You are living, but you are not the Hermann Göring who was born in Marienbad Sanatorium at Rosenheim in Bavaria on January the 12th, 1893. You are not the Hermann Göring whose godfather was Dr. Hermann Eppenstein, a Jew converted to Christianity. You are not the Göring who succeeded von Richthofen after his death and continued to lead his flyers against the Allies even after the war ended. You are not the Reichsmarschall of Hitler's Germany, nor the refugee arrested by Lieutenant Jerome N. Shapiro. Eppenstein and Shapiro. And you are not the Hermann Göring who took his life by swallowing potassium cyanide during his trial for his crimes against humanity. Göring tamped his pipe with tobacco and said mildly, "You certainly know much about me. I should be flattered, I suppose. At least I was not forgotten." "Generally you were," Frigate said. "You did have a long-lived reputation as a sinister clown, a failure and a toady." Burton was surprised. He hadn't known that the fellow would stand up to someone who had power of life and death over him, or who had treated him so painfully. But then perhaps Frigate hoped to be killed. It was probably that he was banking on Göring's curiosity. Göring said, "Explain your statement. Not about my reputation. Every man of importance expects to be reviled and misunderstood by the brainless masses. Explain why I am not the same man." Frigate smiled slightly and said, "You are the product, the hybrid of a recording and an energy-matter converter. You were made with all the memories of the dead man, Hermann Göring, and with every cell of his body a duplicate. You have everything he had, so you think you are Göring, but you are not. You are a duplication, and that is all. The original Hermann Göring is nothing but molecules that have been absorbed into the soil and the air, and so into plants, and back into the flesh of beasts and men, and out again as excrement and so weiter. But you here before me are not the original any more than the recording on a disc or a tape is the original voice, the vibrations issuing from the mouth of a man and detected and converted by an electronic device and then replayed." Burton understood the reference since he had seen an Edison phonograph in Paris in 1888. He felt outraged, actually violated at Frigate's assertions. Göring's wide-open eyes and reddening face indicated that he too felt threatened down to the core of his being. After stuttering, Göring said, "And why would these beings go through all this trouble just to make duplicates?" Frigate shrugged and said, "I don't know." Göring heaved up from his chair and pointed the stem of his pipe at Frigate. "You lie!" he screamed in German. "You lie, Scheißhund!" Frigate quivered, as if he expected to be struck over the kidneys again, but he said, "I must be right. Of course, you don't have to believe what I say. I can't prove anything. And I understand exactly how you feel. I know that I am Peter Gyrus Frigate, born 1918, died A.D. 2008. But I also must believe, because logic tells me so, that I am only really a being who has the memories of that frigate, who will never rise from the dead. In a sense, I am the son of that frigate, who can never exist again. Not flesh of his flesh, blood of his blood, but mind of his mind. I am not the man who was born of a woman on that lost world of Earth. I am the byblow of science and a machine. Unless..." Göring said, "Yes? Unless what?" "Unless there is some entity attached to the human body. An entity which is the human being. I mean, it contains all that makes the individual what he is, and when the body is destroyed, this entity still exists. So that if the body were to be made again, this entity, storing the essence of the individual, could be attached again to the body. And it would record everything that the body recorded. And so the original individual would live again. He would not be just a duplicate." Burton said, "For God's sake, Pete, are you proposing the soul?" Frigate nodded and said, "Something analogous to the soul? Something that the primitives dimly apprehended and called a soul?" Göring laughed uproariously. Burton would have laughed, but he didn't care to give Göring any support, moral or intellectual. When Göring had quit laughing, he said, "Even here, in a world which is clearly the result of science, the supernaturalists won't quit trying. Well, enough of that. To more practical and immediate matters. Tell me, have you changed your mind? Are you ready to join me?" Burton glared and said, "I would not be under the orders of a man who rapes women. Moreover, I respect the Israelis. I would rather be a slave with them than free with you." Göring scowled and said harshly, "Very well. I thought as much. But I had hoped... Well, I have been having trouble with the Roman. If he gets his way, you will see how merciful I have been to you slaves. You do not know him.
Only my intervention has saved one of you being tortured to death every night for his amusement. At noon, the two returned to their work in the hills. Neither got a chance to speak to Targoff or any of the slaves, since their duties happened not to bring them into contact. They didn't dare make an open attempt to talk to him, because that would have meant a severe beating. After they returned to the stockade in the evening, Burton told the others what had happened. More than likely, Targoff won't believe my story. He'll think we're spies. Even if he's not certain, he can't afford to take chances. So there'll be trouble. It's too bad that this had to happen. The escape plan will have to be cancelled for tonight. Nothing untoward took place, at first. The Israelis walked away from Burton and Frigate when they tried to talk to them. The stars came out, and the stockade was flooded with a light almost as bright as a full moon on Earth. The prisoners stayed inside their barracks, but they talked in low voices with their heads together. Despite their deep tiredness, they couldn't sleep. The guards must have sensed the tension, even though they couldn't see or hear the men in the huts. They walked back and forth on the walks, stood together talking, and peered down into the enclosure by the light of the night sky and the flames of the resin torches. "Targoff will do nothing until it rains," Burton said. He gave orders. Frigate was to stand first watch, Robert Spruce the second, Burton third. Burton lay down on his pile of leaves, and ignoring the murmuring of voices and the moving around of bodies, fell asleep. It seemed that he had just closed his eyes when Spruce touched him. He rose quickly to his feet, yawned, and stretched. The others were all awake. Within a few minutes, the first of the clouds formed. In 10 minutes, the stars were blotted out. Thunder grumbled way up in the mountains, and the first lightning flash forked the sky. Lightning struck near. Burton saw by its flash that the guards were huddled under the roof, sticking out from the base of the watchhouses at each corner of the stockade. They were covered with towels against the chill and the rain. Burton crawled from his barracks to the next. Targoff was standing inside the entrance. Burton stood up and said, "Does the plan still hold?" "You know better than that," Targoff said. A bolt of lightning showed his angry face. "You, Judas!" He stepped forward, and a dozen men followed him. Burton didn't wait. He attacked. But as he rushed forward, he heard a strange sound. He paused to look out through the door. Another flash revealed a guard sprawled face down in the grass beneath a walk. Targoff had put his fists down when Burton turned his back on him. He said, "What's going on, Burton?" "Wait," the Englishman replied. He had no more idea than the Israeli about what was happening, but anything unexpected could be to his advantage. Lightning illuminated the squat figure of Kaz on the wooden walk. He was swinging a huge stone axe against a group of guards who were in the angle formed by the meeting of the two walls. Another flash. The guards were sprawled out on the walk. Darkness. At the next blaze of light, another was down. The remaining two were running away down the walk in different directions. Another bolt, very near the wall, showed that, finally, the other guards were aware of what was happening. They ran down the walk, shouting and waving their spears. Kaz, ignoring them, slid a long bamboo ladder down into the enclosure, and then he threw a bundle of spears after it. By the next flash, he could be seen advancing toward the nearest guards. Burton snatched a spear and almost ran up the ladder. The others, including the Israeli, were behind him. The fight was bloody and brief. With the guards on the walk either stabbed or hurled to their deaths, only those in the watchhouses remained. The ladder was carried to the other end of the stockade and placed against the gate. In 2 minutes, men had climbed to the outside, dropped down, and opened the gate. For the first time, Burton found a chance to talk to Kaz.
"I thought you had sold us out."
"No, not me, Kaz," Kaz said reproachfully. "You know I love you, Burton Nack. You're my friend, my chief. I pretend to join your enemies because that's playing it smart. I surprise you don't do the same. You're no dummy."
"Certainly you aren't," Burton said, "but I couldn't bring myself to kill those slaves."
Lightning revealed Kaz shrugging. He said, "That don't bother me. I don't know them. Besides, you hear Goering. He say they die anyway."
"It's a good thing you chose tonight to rescue us," Burton said. He didn't tell Kaz why, since he didn't want to confuse him. Moreover, there were more important things to do.
Tonight's a good night for this,
Kaz said.
Big battle going on. Tullius and Göring get very drunk and quarrel. They fight. Their men fight. While they kill each other, invaders come. Those brown men across the river, what you call them? Onondagas? That's them. Their boats come just before rain come. They make raid to steal slaves, too, or maybe just for the hell of it. So I think now's good time to start my plan. Get Burton Nuck free.
As suddenly as it had come, the rain ceased. Burton could hear shouts and screams from far off toward the river. Drums were beating up and down the riverbanks. He said to Targoth, "We can either try to escape, and probably do so easily, or we can attack."
"I intend to wipe out the beasts who enslaved us," Targoth said. "There are other stockades nearby. I've sent men to open their gates. The rest are too far away to reach quickly. They're strung out at half-mile intervals." By then, the blockhouse in which the off-duty guards lived had been stormed. The slaves armed themselves and then started toward the noise of the conflict. Burton's group was on the right flank. They hadn't gone half a mile before they came upon corpses and wounded, a mixture of Onondagas and whites. Despite the heavy rain, a fire had broken out. By its increasing light, they saw that the flames came from the longhouse. Outlined in the glare were struggling figures. The escapees advanced across the plain. Suddenly, one side broke and ran toward them, with the victors whooping and screaming jubilantly after them.
"There's Göring," Frigate said. "His fat isn't going to help him get away, that's for sure."
He pointed, and Burton could see the German desperately pumping his legs but falling behind the others.
"I don't want the Indians to have the honor of killing him," Burton said. "We owe it to Alice to get him."
Campbell's long-legged figure was ahead of them all, and it was toward him that Burton threw his spear. To the Scot, the missile must have seemed to come out of the darkness from nowhere. Too late, he tried to dodge. The flint head buried itself in the flesh between his left shoulder and chest, and he fell on his side. He tried to get up a moment afterward, but he was kicked back down by Burton. Campbell's eyes rolled. Blood trickled from his mouth. He pointed at another wound, a deep gash in his side just below the ribs.
"You, you're a woman. Wilfrida did that," he gasped. "But I killed her, the bitch."
Burton wanted to ask him where Alice was, but Kaz, screaming phrases in his native tongue, brought his club down on the Scot's head. Burton picked up his spear and ran after Kaz.
"Don't kill Göring," he shouted. "Leave him to me."
Kaz didn't hear him. He was busy fighting with two Onondagas. Burton saw Alice as she ran by him. He reached out and grabbed her and spun her around. She screamed and started to struggle. Burton shouted at her. Suddenly, recognizing him, she collapsed into his arms and began weeping. Burton would have tried to comfort her, but he was afraid that Göring would escape him. He pushed her away and ran toward the German and threw his spear. It grazed Göring's head, and he screamed and stopped running and began to look for the weapon, but Burton was on him. Both fell to the ground and rolled over and over, each trying to strangle the other. Something struck Burton on the back of his head. Stunned, he released his grip. Göring pushed him down on the ground and dived toward the spear. Seizing it, he rose and stepped toward the prostrate Burton. Burton tried to get to his feet, but his knees seemed to be made of putty, and everything was whirling. Göring suddenly staggered as Alice tackled his legs from behind, and he fell forward. Burton made another effort, found he could at least stagger, and sprawled over Göring. Again they rolled over and over, with Göring squeezing on Burton's throat. Then a shaft slid over Burton's shoulder, burning his skin, and its stone tip drove into Göring's throat. Burton stood up, pulled the spear out, and plunged it into the man's fat belly. Göring tried to sit up, but he fell back and died. Alice slumped to the ground and wept. Dawn saw the end of the battle. By then the slaves had broken out of every stockade. The warriors of Göring and Tullius were ground between the two forces, Onondaga and slaves, like husks between millstones. The Indians, who had probably raided only to loot and get more slaves and their grails, retreated. They climbed aboard their dugouts and canoes and paddled across the lake. Nobody felt like chasing them. Chapter 17. The days that followed were busy ones.
A rough census indicated that at least half of the 20,000 inhabitants of Goering's little kingdom had been killed, severely wounded, abducted by the Onondaga, or had fled. The Roman, Tullius Hostilius, had apparently escaped. The survivors chose a provisional government. Targoff, Burton, Spruce, Ruach, and two others formed an executive committee with considerable but temporary powers. John de Greystock had disappeared. He had been seen during the beginning of the battle, and then he had just dropped out of sight. Alice Hargreaves moved into Burton's hut without either saying a word about the why or wherefore. Later, she said, "Frigate tells me that if this entire planet is constructed like the areas we've seen, and there's no reason to believe it isn't, then the river must be at least 20 million miles long. It's incredible, but so is our resurrection, everything about this world. Also, there may be 35 to 37 billion people living along the river. What chance would I have of ever finding my earthly husband? Moreover, I love you. Yes, I know I didn't act as if I loved you, but something has changed in me. Perhaps it's all I've been through that's responsible. I don't think I could have loved you on Earth. I might have been fascinated, but I would also have been repelled, perhaps frightened. I couldn't have made you a good wife there. Here I can. Rather, I'll make you a good mate, since there doesn't seem to be any authority or religious institutions that could marry us. That in itself shows how I've changed. That I could be calmly living with a man I'm not married to. Well, there you are."
"We're no longer living in the Victorian age," Burton said. "What would you call this present age? The mélange era, the mixed age? Eventually it will be the river culture, the riparian world, rather many river cultures."
"Providing it lasts," Alice said. "It started suddenly. It may end just as swiftly and unexpectedly."
Certainly, Burton thought, the green river and the grassy plain and the forested hills and the unscalable mountains didn't seem like Shakespeare's insubstantial vision. They were solid, real as the men walking toward him now, Frigate, Monat, Kaz, and Ruach. He stepped out of the hut and greeted them. Kaz began talking.
"A long time ago, before I speak English good, I see something. I tried to tell you then, but you don't understand me. I see a man who don't have this on his forehead."
He pointed at the center of his own forehead and then at that of the others.
"I know," Kaz continued, "you can't see it. Pete and Monat can't either, nobody else can. But I see it, on everybody's forehead, except on that man I tried to catch long time ago. Then one day I see a woman don't have it, but I don't say nothing to you. Now I see a third person who don't have it."
"He means," Monat said, "that he is able to perceive certain symbols or characters on the forehead of each and every one of us. He can see these only in bright sunlight and at a certain angle, but everyone he's ever seen has had these symbols, except for the three he's mentioned."
"He must be able to see a little further into the spectrum than we," Frigate said. "Obviously, whoever stamped us with the sign of the beast, or whatever you want to call it, didn't know about the special ability of Kaz's species, which shows that they are not omniscient."
"Obviously," Burton said, "nor infallible. Otherwise, I would never have awakened in that place before being resurrected. So who is this person who doesn't have these symbols on his skin?" He spoke calmly, but his heart beat swiftly. If Kaz was right, he might have detected an agent of the beings who had brought the entire human species to life again. Would they be gods in disguise?
"Robert Spruce," Frigate said.
"Before we jump to any conclusions," Monat said, "don't forget that the omission may have been an accident."
"We'll find out," Burton said ominously. "But why the symbols? Why should we be marked?"
"Probably for identification or numbering purposes," Monat said. "Who knows, except those who put us here?"
"Let's go face Spruce," Burton said.
"We have to catch him first," Frigate replied. "Kaz made the mistake of mentioning to Spruce that he knew about the symbols.
He did so at breakfast this morning. I wasn't there, but those who were said Spruce turned pale. A few minutes later he excused himself, and he hasn't been seen since. We've sent search parties out up and down the river, across the river, and also into the hills. His flight is an admission of guilt, Burton said. He was angry. Was man a kind of cattle branded for some sinister purpose? That afternoon, the drums announced that Spruce had been caught. 3 hours later, he was standing before the council table in the newly built meeting hall. Behind the table sat the council. The doors were closed, for the councilman felt that this was something that could be conducted more efficiently without a crowd. However, Monat, Kaz, and Frigate were also present. "I may as well tell you now," Burton said, "that we have decided to go to any lengths to get the truth from you. It is against the principles of everyone at this table to use torture. We despise and loathe those who resort to torture. But we feel that this is one issue where principles must be abandoned."
"Principles must never be abandoned," Spruce said evenly. "The end never justifies the means, even if clinging to them means defeat, death, and remaining in ignorance."
"There's too much at stake," Tarkov said. "I, who have been the victim of unprincipled men, Ruach, who has been tortured several times, the others, we all agree, will use fire and the knife on you if we must. It is necessary that we find out the truth. Now tell me, are you one of those responsible for this resurrection?"
"You will be no better than Goering and his kind if you torture me," Spruce said. His voice was beginning to break.
"In fact, you will be far worse off, for you are forcing yourselves to be like him in order to gain something that may not even exist, or if it does, may not be worth the price." "Tell us the truth," Tarkov said. "Don't lie. We know that you must be an agent, perhaps one of those directly responsible." "There is a fire blazing in that stone over there," Burton said. "If you don't start talking at once, you will... well, the roasting you get will be the least of your pain. I'm an authority on Chinese and Arabic methods of torture. I assure you that they had some very refined means for extracting the truth, and I have no qualms about putting my knowledge into practice."
Spruce, pale and sweating, said, "You may be denying yourself eternal life if you do this. It will at least set you far back on your journey, delay the final goal."
"What is that?" Burton replied.
Spruce ignored him. "We can't stand pain," he muttered. "We're too sensitive."
"Are you going to talk?" Tarkov said.
"Even the idea of self-destruction is painful and to be avoided except when absolutely necessary," Spruce mumbled, "despite the fact that I know I shall live again."
"Put him over the fire," Tarkov said to the two men who held Spruce. Monat spoke up.
"Just one moment."
"Spruce, the science of my people was much more advanced than that of Earth's, so I am more qualified to make an educated guess. Perhaps we could spare you the pain of the fire and the pain of betraying your purpose if you were merely to affirm what I have to say. That way, you wouldn't be making a positive betrayal."
Spruce said, "I'm listening."
"It's my theory that you are a terrestrial. You belong to an age chronologically far past A.D. 2008. You must be the descendant of the few who survived my death scanner. Judging by the technology and power required to reconstruct the surface of this planet into one vast river valley, your time must be much later than the 21st century. Just guessing, the 50th century A.D.?"
Spruce looked at the fire, then said,
"Add 2,000 more years. If this planet is about the size of the Earth, it can only hold so many people. Where are the others? The stillborn, the children who died before they were 5, the imbeciles and idiots, and those who lived after the 20th century?"
"They are elsewhere," Spruce said. He glanced at the fire again, and his lips tightened.
"My own people," Monat said, "had a theory that they would eventually be able to see into their past. I won't go into the details, but it was possible that past events could be visually detected and then recorded. Time travel,
of course, was sheer fantasy. But what if your culture was able to do what we only theorized about? What if you recorded every single human being that had ever lived, located this planet and constructed this river valley? Somewhere, maybe under the very surface of this planet, used energy-matter conversion, say from the heat of this planet's molten core and the recordings to recreate the bodies of the dead in the tanks. Used biological techniques to rejuvenate the bodies and to restore limbs, eyes, and so on, and also to correct any physical defects. Then, Monat continued, you made more recordings of the newly created bodies and stored them in some vast memory tank. Later you destroyed the bodies in the tanks, recreated them again through means of the conductive metal which is also used to charge the grails. These could be buried beneath the ground. The resurrection then occurs without recourse to supernatural means. The big question is why? If you had it in your power to do all this, would you not think it was your ethical duty? Spruce asked. Yes, but I would resurrect only those worth resurrecting. And what if others did not accept your criteria? Spruce said. Do you really think you are wise enough and good enough to judge? Would you place yourself on a level with God? No. All must be given a second chance, no matter how bestial or selfish or petty or stupid. Then it will be up to them. He fell silent, as if he had regretted his outburst and meant to say no more. Besides, Monat said, you would want to make a study of humanity as it existed in the past. You would want to record all the languages that man ever spoke, his mores, his philosophies, biographies. To do this, you need agents posing as resurrectees to mingle with the river people and to take notes, to observe, to study. How long will this study take? 1,000 years? 2? 10? 1,000,000? And what about the eventual disposition of us? Are we to stay here forever? You will stay here as long as it takes for you to be rehabilitated, Spruce shouted. Then, he closed his mouth, glared, then opened it to say, continued contact with you makes even the toughest of us take on your characteristics. We have to go through a rehabilitation ourselves. Already I feel unclean. Put him over the fire, Targov said. We'll get the entire truth. No, you won't, Spruce cried. I should have done this long ago. Who knows what? He fell to the ground, and his skin changed to a gray-blue color. Dr. Steinborg, a councilman, examined him, but it was apparent to all that he was dead. Targov said, Better take him away now, doctor. Dissect him. We'll wait here for your reports. With stone knives, no chemicals, no microscopes, what kind of a report can you expect? Steinborg said. But I'll do my best. The body was carried off. Burton said, I'm glad he didn't force us to admit we were bluffing. If he had kept his mouth shut, he could have defeated us. Then you really weren't going to torture him? Frigate said. I was hoping you didn't mean your threat. If you had, I was going to walk out then and there and never see any of you again. Of course we didn't mean it, Ruach said. Spruce would have been right. We'd have been no better than Goering, but we could have tried other means. Hypnotism, for instance. Burton, Monat and Steinborg were experts in that field. The trouble is, we still don't know if we did get the truth, Targov said. Actually, he may have been lying. Monat supplied some guesses, and if these were wrong, Spruce could have led us astray by agreeing with Monat. I'd say we can't be at all sure. They agreed on one thing. Their chances of detecting another agent through the absence of symbols on the forehead would be gone. Now that they, whoever they were, knew about the visibility of the characters to Kaz's species, they would take the proper measures to prevent detection. Steinborg returned 3 hours later. There is nothing to distinguish him from any other member of Homo sapiens, except this one little device. He held up a black shiny ball about the size of a match head. I located this on the surface of the forebrain. It was attached to some nerves by wires so thin that I could see them only at a certain angle when they caught the light. It's my opinion that Spruce killed himself by means of this device, and that he did so by literally thinking himself dead. Somehow this little ball translated a wish for death into the deed. Perhaps it reacted to the thought by releasing a poison which I do not have facilities for analyzing. He concluded his report and passed the ball around to the others.
Chapter 18. 30 days later, Burton, Frigate, Ruach, and Kaz were returning from a trip upriver. It was just before dawn. The cold, heavy mists that piled up to 6 or 7 feet above the river in the latter part of the night swirled around them. They couldn't see in any direction further than a strong man might make a standing broad jump. But Burton, standing in the prow of the bamboo-hulled, single-masted boat, knew they were close to the western shore. Near the relatively shallow depths, the current ran more slowly, and they had just steered to port from the middle of the river. If his calculations were correct, they should be close to the ruins of Goering's Hall. At any moment, he expected to see a strip of denser darkness appear out of the dark waters, the banks of that land he now called home. Home, for Burton, had always been a place from which to sally forth, a resting place, a temporary fortress in which to write a book about his last expedition, a lair in which to heal fresh hurts, a conning tower from which he looked out for new lands to explore. Thus, only 2 weeks after the death of Spruce, Burton had felt the need to get to some place other than the one in which he now was. He heard a rumor that copper had been discovered on the western shore about 100 miles upriver. This was a length of shore of not more than 12 miles, inhabited by 5th century B.C. Sarmatians and 13th century A.D. Frisians. Burton didn't really think the story was true, but it gave him an excuse to travel. Ignoring Alice's pleas to take her with him, he had set off. Now, a month later, and after some adventures, not all unpleasant, they were almost home. The story hadn't been entirely unfounded. There was copper, but only in minute amounts. So the four had gotten into their boat for the easy trip down current, their sail pushed by the never-ceasing wind. They journeyed during the daytime and beached the boat during meal times, wherever there were friendly people who didn't mind strangers using their grailstones. At night, they either slept among the friendlies or, if in hostile waters, sailed by in the darkness. The last leg of their trip was made after the sun went down. Before getting home, they had to pass a section of the valley where slave-hungry 18th-century Mohawks lived on one side and equally greedy Carthaginians of the 3rd century B.C. on the other. Having slipped through under cover of the fog, they were almost home. Abruptly, Burton said, "There's the bank. Pete, lower the mast. Kaz, Lev, back oars. Jump to it." A few minutes later, they had landed and had pulled the lightweight craft completely out of the water and upon the gently sloping shore. Now that they were out of the mists, they could see the sky paling above the eastern mountains. "Dead reckoning come alive," Burton said. "We're 10 paces beyond the Grailstone near the ruins." He scanned the bamboo huts along the plain and the buildings evident in the long grasses and under the giant trees of the hills. Not a single person was to be seen. The valley was asleep. He said, "Don't you think it's strange that no one's up yet, or that we've not been challenged by the sentinels?" Frigate pointed toward the lookout tower to their right. Burton swore and said, "They're asleep, by God, or deserted their post." But he knew, as he spoke, that this was no case of dereliction of duty. Though he had said nothing to the others about it, the moment he had stepped ashore, he had been sure something was very wrong. He began running across the plain toward the hut in which he and Alice lived. Alice was sleeping on the bamboo and grass bed on the right side of the building. Only her head was visible, for she was curled up under a blanket of towels fastened to each other by the magnetic clasps. Burton threw the blanket back, got down on his knees by the low bed, and raised her to a sitting position. Her head lolled forward and her arms hung limply, but she had a healthy color and breathed normally. Burton called her name 3 times. She slept on. He slapped both her cheeks sharply. Red splotches sprang up on them. Her eyelids fluttered, and she went back to sleep. By then, Frigate and Ruach appeared. "We've looked into some of the other huts," Frigate said. "They're all asleep. I tried to wake a couple of them, but they're out for the count. What's wrong? Burton said, Who do you think has the power or the need to do this?
Spruce and his kind, whoever they are?
Why? Frigate sounded frightened.
They were looking for me. They must have come in under the fog, somehow put this whole area to sleep.
A sleep gas would do it easily enough, Ruach said,
although people who have powers such as theirs could have devices we've never dreamed of.
They were looking for me, Burton shouted.
Which means, if true, that they may be back tonight, Frigate said. But why would they be searching for you?
Ruach replied for Burton, because he, as far as we know, was the only man to awaken in the pre-resurrection phase. Why he did is a mystery, but it's evident something went wrong.
It may also be a mystery to them.
I'd be inclined to think they've been discussing this and finally decided to come here, maybe to kidnap Burton for observation or some more sinister purpose.
Possibly. They wanted to erase from my memory all that I'd seen in that chamber of floating bodies, Burton said. Such a thing shouldn't be beyond their science.
But you've told that story to many, Frigate said. They couldn't possibly track down all those people and remove the memory of your story from their minds.
Would that be necessary? How many believe my tale? Sometimes I doubt it myself.
Ruach said, Speculation is fruitless. What do we do now?
Alice shrieked, Richard!
And they turned to see her sitting up and staring at them.
For a few minutes they could not get her to understand what had happened.
Finally she said, So that's why the fog covered the land, too. I thought it was strange, but of course I had no way of knowing what was really happening.
Burton said, Get your grails. Put anything you want to take along in your sack. We're leaving as of now. I want to get away before the others awake.
Alice's already large eyes became even wider.
Where are we going?
Anywhere from here. I don't like to run away, but I can't stand up and fight people like that. Not if they know where I am. I'll tell you, however, what I plan to do. I intend to find the end of the river. It must have an inlet and an outlet, and there must be a way for a man to get through to the source. If there's any way at all, I'll find it. You can bet your soul on that. Meanwhile, they'll be looking for me elsewhere, I hope. The fact that they didn't find me here makes me think that they have no means for instantly locating a person. They may have branded us like cattle, he indicated the invisible symbols on his forehead, but even cattle have mavericks, and we're cattle with brains. He turned to the others. You're more than welcome to come along with me. In fact, I'd be honored.
I'll get Monat, Kaz said. He wouldn't want to be left behind.
Burton grimaced and said, Good old Monat. I hate to do this to him, but there's no helping it. He can't come along. He's too distinguishable. Their agents would have no trouble at all in locating anybody who looked like him. I'm sorry, but he can't.
Tears stood in Kaz's eyes, then ran down his bulging cheekbones. In a choked voice he said, Burton, Nack, I can't go either. I look too different, too.
Burton felt tears wet his own eyes. He said, We'll take that chance. After all, there must be plenty of your type around. We've seen at least 30 or more during our travels.
No females so far, Burton Nack, Kaz said mournfully. Then he smiled. Maybe we find one when we go along the river.
As quickly he lost his grin.
No, damn it, I don't go. I can't hurt Monat too much. Him and me, others think we ugly and scary-looking, so we become good friends. He's not my Nack, but he's next to it. I stay.
He stepped up to Burton, hugged him in a grip that forced Burton's breath out in a great whoosh, released him, shook hands with the others, making them wince, then turned and shuffled off.
Ruach, holding his paralyzed hand, said, You're off on a fool's errand, Burton. You realize that you could sail on this river for 1,000 years and still be 1,000,000 miles or more from the end?
I'm staying. My people need me. Besides, Spruce made it clear that we should be striving for a spiritual perfection, not fighting those who gave us a chance to do so.
Burton's teeth flashed whitely in his dark face. He swung his grail as if it were a weapon.
I didn't ask to be put here any more than I asked to be born on Earth.
I don't intend to kowtow to another's dictates. I mean to find the river's end, and if I don't, I will at least have had fun and learned much on the way.
By then, people were beginning to stumble out of their huts, as they yawned and rubbed heavy eyes. Ruach paid no attention to them. He watched the craft as it set sail, close-hauled to the wind, cutting across and up the river. Burton was handling the rudder. He turned once and waved the grail so that the sun bounced off it in many shining spheres. Ruach thought that Burton was really happy that he had been forced to make this decision. Now he could evade the deadly responsibilities that would come with governing this little state, and could do what he wanted. He could set out on the greatest of all his adventures. "I suppose it's for the best," Ruach muttered to himself. "A man may find salvation on the road if he wants to, just as well as he may at home. It's up to him. Meanwhile, I, like Voltaire's character, what was his name? Earthly things are beginning to slip away from me, will cultivate my own little garden." He paused to look somewhat longingly after Burton. "Who knows? He may some day run into Voltaire." He sighed, then smiled. "On the other hand, Voltaire may some day drop in on me."
Chapter 19. "I hate you, Hermann Göring!"
The voice sprang out and then flashed away as if it were a gear tooth meshed with the cog of another man's dream and rotated into and then out of his dream. Riding the crest of the hypno-pompic state, Richard Francis Burton knew he was dreaming, but he was helpless to do anything about it. The first dream returned. Events were fuzzy and encapsulated. A lightning streak of himself in the unmeasurable chamber of floating bodies. Another flash of the nameless custodians finding him and putting him back to sleep. Then a jerky synopsis of the dream he had had just before the true resurrection on the banks of the river. God, a beautiful old man in the clothes of a mid-Victorian gentleman of means and breeding, was poking him in the ribs with an iron cane and telling him that he owed for the flesh. "What? What flesh?" Burton said, dimly aware that he was muttering in his sleep. He couldn't hear his words in the dream. "Pay up," God said. His face melted, then was recast into Burton's own features. God hadn't answered in the first dream 5 years before. He spoke now. "Make your resurrection worth my while, you fool. I have gone to great expense and even greater pains to give you and all those other miserable and worthless wretches a second chance." "Second chance at what?" Burton said. He felt frightened at what God might answer. He was much relieved when God, the All-Father, only now did Burton see that one eye of Yahweh, Odin, was gone and out of the empty socket glared the flames of hell, did not reply. He was gone, no, not gone, but metamorphosed into a high gray tower, cylindrical and soaring out of gray mists with the roar of the sea coming up through the mists. "The Grail!" He saw again the man who had told him of the big grail. This man had heard it from another man, who had heard it from a woman, who had heard it from... and so forth. The big grail was one of the legends told by the billions who lived along the river. This river, that coiled like a serpent around this planet from pole to pole, issued from the unreachable and plunged into the inaccessible. A man, or a subhuman, had managed to climb through the mountains to the North Pole, and he had just seen the big grail, the dark tower, the misty castle, just before he had stumbled. Or he was pushed. He had fallen headlong and bellowing into the cold seas beneath the mists, and died. And then the man, or subhuman, had awakened again along the river. Death was not forever here, although it had lost nothing of its sting. He had told of his vision, and the story had traveled along the valley of the river faster than a boat could sail. Thus, Richard Francis Burton, the eternal pilgrim and wanderer, had longed to storm the ramparts of the Big Grail. He would unveil the secret of resurrection and of this planet, since he was convinced that the beings who had reshaped this world had also built that tower.
"Die, Hermann Göring, die and leave me in peace," a man shouted in German.
Burton opened his eyes.
He could see nothing except the pale sheen of the multitudinous stars through the open window across the room of the hut. His vision bent to the shape of the black things inside, and he saw Peter Frigget and Logu sleeping on their mats by the opposite wall. He turned his head to see the white, blanket-sized towel under which Alice slept. The whiteness of her face was turned toward him, and the black cloud of her hair spilled out on the ground by her mat. That same evening, the single-masted boat on which he and the other three had been sailing down the river had put into a friendly shore. The little state of Sevieria was inhabited largely by 16th-century Englishmen, although its chief was an American who had lived in the late 18th and early 19th century. John Sevier, founder of the lost state of Franklin, which had later become Tennessee, had welcomed Burton and his party. Sevier and his people did not believe in slavery and wouldn't detain any guest longer than he desired. After permitting them to charge their grails and so feed themselves, Sevier had invited them to a party. It was the celebration of Resurrection Day. Afterward, he had them conducted to the guest hostelry. Burton was always a light sleeper, and now he was an uneasy one. The others began breathing deeply or snoring long before he had succumbed to weariness. After an interminable dream, he had wakened on hearing the voice that had interlocked with his dreams. Hermann Göring, Burton thought. He had killed Göring, but Göring must be alive again, somewhere along the river. Was the man now groaning and shouting in the neighboring hut, one who had also suffered because of Göring either on earth or in the river valley? Burton threw off the black towel and rose swiftly, but noiselessly. He secured a kilt with magnetic tabs, fastened a belt of human skin around his waist, and made sure the human leather scabbard held the flint poignard. Carrying an assegai, a short length of hardwood tipped with a flint point, he left the hut. The moonless sky cast a light as bright as the full moon of Earth. It was aflame with huge, many-colored stars and pale sheets of cosmic gas. The hostelries were set back a mile and a half from the river and placed on one of the second row of hills that edged the river plain. There were seven of the one-roomed, leaf-thatched, roofed bamboo buildings. At a distance, under the enormous branches of the iron trees or under the giant pines or oaks, were other huts. A half mile away, on top of a high hill, was a large circular stockade, colloquially termed the roundhouse. The officials of Sevieria slept there. High towers of bamboo were placed every half mile along the river shore. Torches flamed all night long on platforms from which sentinels kept a lookout for invaders. After scrutinizing the shadows under the trees, Burton walked a few steps to the hut from which the groans and shouts had come. He pushed the grass curtain aside. The starlight fell through the open window on the face of the sleeper. Burton hissed in surprise. The light revealed the blondish hair and the broad features of a youth he recognized.